This is Trudy Hinson with the Center for Health and Homeland Security, and I'm here today with Christine Gentry, Senior Law and Policy Analyst, and we're going to be talking about the newly named novel coronavirus, COVID-19. And we're going to be focusing on legal issues with quarantine and isolation, different areas that have been coming up in the news, and just some legal background on that. First, Christine is going to give us some updates on the COVID-19 situation in general.
Thanks, Trudy. Thanks for having me back.
Of course.
So I'm just going to talk specifically about what the lay of the quarantine land looks like right now. If you've been following this at all, you know that China almost immediately initiated a citywide quarantine and expanded the quarantine to three nearby cities. But right. Sort of due to the time that this all came about, there were a lot of people traveling to and from the area, so there were a lot of complications with instituting a quarantine at that exact time. So now China has moved towards sort of mass confinements at quarantine centers. As we discussed, they're doing house-to-house temperature checks, trying to make sure that people who have symptoms are going to the quarantine centers. And they've also restricted certain over-the-counter medications in order to get people to sort of step forward and right. voluntarily go to the quarantine centers. So another big quarantine issue in the news, of course, is the cruise ship that's
outside of Japan.
Yeah, outside Tokyo, with over 200 confirmed cases. I think yesterday was 218.
Yes. Yeah, and I think right now that is the largest amount of confirmed COVID-19 cases outside of China, is that cruise ship.
Mm-hmm. So it's a cruise ship of over 3,500 people, and 218 people are confirmed with the virus, which is a tough position for the others on the cruise because they can't leave.
Absolutely. And I believe I read that they had started, as of today, they were going to offer passengers that were 80 years old and over the opportunity to get off the boat. They would be quarantined still, but they could leave the boat, 80 year olds and over. And then if I read correctly, then they're going to be stepping the age down to sort of allow other people to get off the boat. Largely, I think, because they realize that they have sort of created, with the best intentions, a situation where the virus is not going to leave the boat necessarily, but if you're on the boat, we're seeing high rates of infection, and there's really nowhere else for those people to go.
And then age population is especially vulnerable to, all types of things, including the COVID-19 and flu and things of that nature.
Yes.
So that's a very interesting move. But the cruise ship situation brings to mind the history of quarantine and how it came about. In general.
Yeah, it kind of brings us full circle. I'm not going to attempt the Latin, but quarantine comes from the Latin for 40, quarter, four, and that comes from...
What was that?
quarters, something with quarters and fours.
Mm-hmm.
That comes from back a long time ago, for a long time, that was the practice. Anytime ships came into new cities or ports, the boat stayed docked with nothing coming off for 40 days to make sure that any people or animals on there weren't carrying disease that could infect the city they were coming into.
Mm.
So we've kind of come full circle on that.
Mm-hmm. So back in the United States, the CDC yesterday confirmed a 15th case.
Yes.
And they've made some fairly dramatic moves that we haven't seen done in a long time. The borders are closed to foreign nationals who visited China recently. CDC is mandating a 14-day quarantine for U.S. citizens who visited the Hubei province recently. And I think, so on this last Tuesday, 195 people who had been in federal quarantine were released.
Right.
But there's still about 600 people in federal quarantine.
Yeah, they're still watching about 600 people under that federal quarantine. And we've had a couple, there was actually one of those people that were being watched that tested positive for the COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
So that's ongoing.
Interesting. So what's happening around the world right now with the coronavirus? Oh, excuse me, COVID-19.
COVID-19, it's a tough shift to make.
Yes, it's really rolls off the tongue, their new name.
It does.
Yes. So, and people can sort of guess about what quarantine does and what the purpose is, but could you tell us just more explicitly, why are we quarantining people?
Sure. So the idea behind quarantine and isolation, again, it's one of our oldest public health measures, because before we understood germ theory, before we had modern medicine, we were smart people even back then, and we figured out, you know, if you keep people from circulating, then the disease doesn't circulate as fast as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the idea behind quarantine and isolation, is that you prevent the disease from spreading by mm-hmm. keeping those that have the disease, whatever it is, in this case COVID-19, from going out and spreading that disease. We've sort of gotten a little more modern about it and statutory about it, so we have procedures in place, and there's a little bit more legal garments on it, the way that we go about quarantining mm-hmm. and isolating and that
protections
part has changed. Yes, protections,
yeah.
In the United States at least, we have due process protections mm-hmm. in general, and with quarantine and isolation procedures, due process protections are included in mm-hmm. those as well. So what we see in China, where the government announces it's closing transportation and basically kind of dropping a net around a city, that would be very difficult to do in the United States because we do have those due process protections, and you have the right to challenge a quarantine order, whether it's issued at the state level mm-hmm. or at the federal level.
Mm. So you mentioned isolation and quarantine just now. And what's the difference between them?
Well, it's a distinction that very few people make. It's very often we lump them together, but quarantine and isolation are actually different. So quarantine is when you distance people based on the suspicion that they might have been exposed to the disease. And mm-hmm. isolation is when you are creating that distance or isolating the person because they're actually ill and you've confirmed that illness. So I'm a big believer in mnemonic devices. If you ever need to remember this
professor,
distinction. Yeah, exactly.
The professor coming out on you.
So if you remember illness for isolation, they both start with I. That's one way you mm-hmm. can keep them straight. But most of the time people talk about quarantine and isolation. They just are lumping it together.
Interchangeably, yeah.
Yeah.
So these quarantine and isolation powers are potentially very extreme.
Yes.
Where do these powers derive from in the United States?
So in the United States, we've had quarantine and isolation measures. They're some of the oldest laws on the books, starting at the local level, and they come from a couple of different places. So at the federal level, there is a federal quarantine power, and that's derived from the Commerce Clause, the idea that you can control what's happening mm. between mm-hmm. states' borders. At the state level, it's reserved to the states by the 10th Amendment for the police powers, and that's where the states get their power, is that reserved power.
Interesting. Yeah.
And then most states have, well, all states have a statutory framework as well that sort of lays out more specifically what that quarantine and isolation power is, and there's a lot of information about how those orders must be done, sort of the circumstances in which they can be issued,
mm-hmm.
and most states have additional language about the due process protection, so how to challenge an order, limited time frames in mm-hmm. which you can challenge that order. So it's a much speedier process if you're challenging a quarantine order than, say, if you're taking someone to court for, hitting your car.
Right. And we have seen someone challenge a quarantine order fairly
we
recently.
Have.
Yeah.
So one of the interesting things that happened back in 2014 and 15 with the Ebola, it was an outbreak on a global scale in certain countries. It certainly wasn't an outbreak in the U.S., but we had enough cases to test some of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw that with Casey Hickox, the nurse from mm-hmm. New Jersey, mm-hmm. who returned from helping in West Africa, I believe with Doctors Without Borders. And she had the timing, I won't say fortune, of returning just after the governor of New Jersey had announced his quarantine policy, which was to quarantine anyone returning from those West African countries. And she registered a fever on the scan, on the forehead scan, and she was sort of unceremoniously taken into quarantine, which at that point was a tent outside with a portable toilet.
Yeah, very basic accommodations.
Very basic. And it was unfortunate for her. She had very strong feelings on it, and she was very forthright about asking for certain protections, and she was able to change her situation. And I think it spurned a very important discussion about how quarantine and isolation is implemented in the United States. Even when we have these due process protections, sometimes we see policies that are being implemented that aren't science-based and aren't necessarily thought through how everything will be carried out. And I think that's kind of what we saw. When she left New Jersey, which she was able to do, she was still under quarantine in her home state of Maine. She challenged that quarantine as well because it was confining her to her house, and her contention was that that wasn't necessary, that that was not how Ebola was transmitted.
Well, she wasn't
symptomatic. She wasn't a risk or a public health risk. She challenged that order, and it really spurned that national discussion about quarantine and isolation and the policies put in place. And quarantine and isolation, many states haven't looked at their statutes in quite a while to make sure that they kind of align with modern times. It's a different time now than 100 years ago for a lot of different reasons. And there's a need to look at how we quarantine and isolate and how to do that in a modern society where we are, I mean, we're just all intertwined in a very different way.
Right. I mean, and that's the case for many public health emergency
absolutely
laws. They're oftentimes very outdated.
Right.
Yeah. So you mentioned that governors have the power to do mandatory quarantine orders. Anybody else?
So at the state level, governors have the ability to declare a state of emergency, and once they've declared a state of emergency, depending on the state, they are able to take sort of extraordinary measures. They can suspend any rules or regulations. They can also, for example, in the state of Maryland, they can order in a catastrophic health emergency the Secretary of Health, the state Secretary of Health, to issue orders of quarantine and isolation. So the state Secretary of Health is also imbued with that power. And at the local level, whether those are municipalities or counties, the local health officers have the ability to quarantine and isolate as well. Not necessarily in the case of a public health, a declared public health emergency at the state level, but local health officers have a duty and a responsibility to protect the public health. And so as part of those duties, they're imbued with the power to quarantine when necessary.
That's really interesting. And I think a lot of people don't really realize what their local health officer can do.
They can't. And that's another thing that came out of the 2014 Ebola discussion was the general public was not aware that local health officers and state health officers had this power. So you saw a lot of the news stories focusing on, can public health officers do this? And the question is sort of undeniably answered with a yes, and that has been well established for over 100 years now. But again, the public is not used to those measures, and so the discussion was really about educating the public on that.
So as we're talking about implementing quarantine, be it voluntary or mandatory quarantine measures, just all sorts of really practical policy issue and planning issues pop into my head. How do you enforce this thing? How do you provide like housing? I mean, as we saw in Casey Hickox, it was very primitive conditions since she had very, very little.
Right. And we're a granola bar and a magazine.
Yeah. And we, hopefully have evolved in our approach.
Right. So there's a number, and you're absolutely right. There's a number of practical concerns, especially when you're talking about a full scale or large scale quarantine and isolation. Mm-hmm. You know, what we're seeing in the U.S., even with 600 citizens, that's pretty large for us mm-hmm. as a country to implement that kind of quarantine. When you're talking about a whole city, it becomes very difficult. You know, most states have statutes that require quarantine. Officials who are enforcing the quarantine to provide, you know, conditions that meet certain requirements mm-hmm. that allow the people under the order to talk to their family or communicate with their family. Mm-hmm. You know, there's practical issues like food. If you're telling someone they can't leave wherever they are, you're then sort of taking on the responsibility of their food.
Right.
And the logistics of that can be difficult, but when you start multiplying that by many people, you start thinking about cultural, dietary, all kinds of mm-hmm. considerations. There are a lot of practical issues yeah. with it.
Thinking about water.
Right.
You have to provide them with water, but also there's wastewater.
Yes. Depending on how the disease is transmitted, absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the questions with the cruise ship that mm-hmm. you sort of start wondering about is, you know, you have this crew that are fixing the meals. There are people that are isolated there that are confirmed cases of COVID-19.
Right.
You still have to provide them with food. What are those people that are taking the meals to them? Are they wearing personal protective equipment? They have to wash those dishes. Where is all of that waste going? What are you doing with that? So there's still potential for infection. So quarantine and isolation is not foolproof. It can be effective in preventing the spread of the disease when it's properly implemented. But it's very difficult to implement properly, especially when you're taking into consideration civil liberties the way that we do in the United States. So in the U.S., it's really more about, at this point with COVID-19, mm-hmm. using these measures to buy us a little bit of time to prepare our response, to learn more about the disease that we can, while we can in this sort of window of opportunity, so that if the disease becomes more widespread in the U.S., we're better prepared for it. It's not saying that we won't have what's known as community transmission, which is where the case doesn't just come from out of the country into the country, but is passed from person to person.
Mm-hmm. Talking about potential problems,
yes.
We just read this morning that some people in quarantine escaped in China.
In China, yeah. And I think also in Russia, there were some patients that were being quarantined. So that's one of the issues with quarantine, is that people don't like to be told they can't go places, no matter what country mm-hmm. or cultural differences that you're talking about. So people want to be with their families. They want to be where they're comfortable. And if they are sitting in a room with no access to the things they're used to, if they are not getting information and they don't trust the people that are mm-hmm. providing the treatment, then it's very likely they're going to try to get out of that quarantine. And we're definitely seeing that mm-hmm. In different countries.
It's really, it brings to mind, like, are they addressing people's mental health in these quarantine centers?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's something that if you have the benefit of time to sort of think about your preparations, that's something you can think about. But in the epicenter of an outbreak, that is one of those considerations.
It's
that
a little too late.
You don't have the time to think about.
Mm-hmm. I also read this morning that China set up essentially like crisis counseling hotlines.
Oh, that's good.
Because there's a lot of fear, very understandably, around the situation there right now.
Yeah, and that one of the most important things in any public health crisis is maintaining a trustworthy voice mm-hmm. And providing information to the public, because the public needs to trust you and you need to be trustworthy too. That's important too, but yeah. That messaging can make a big difference in the response.
Mm-hmm. So as we're discussing this, I'm just wondering, why don't we use quarantine and isolation for illnesses and diseases that are much more common? For instance, regular influenza, the seasonal flu, which kills thousands and thousands of Americans every year.
Right.
So clearly we see a huge impact, but there's no real discussion on instituting some sort of quarantine orders
for the flu.
Yeah,
that would be that would make some headlines. I think that's a fair question. It kind of goes back to what the disease is that we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. For one thing, the federal ability to quarantine and the state level too is limited to communicable diseases that are enumerated at the federal level in an executive order by the president.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one limit on that. And pandemic influenza is one of those enumerated diseases, but mm-hmm. seasonal influenza is not considered mm-hmm. that. Now, what's the difference?
Mm-hmm.
You can argue that that's sort of a matter of degrees, because we do see tremendous number of deaths every year from seasonal flu. Mm-hmm. It's not that it's not something that's killing us and infecting thousands and hundreds of thousands of people. I think the difference is we are more equipped to handle the seasonal flu. We sort of know what that disease profile is. It's not as dramatic as some of these novel or emerging diseases that we see, like the hemorrhagic fevers.
Mm-hmm.
It is a difference of degrees. I also think because of the sweeping power that quarantine and isolation orders bring with them and the intrusion on civil liberties, there's an argument to be made that it's just not the balancing test of the interest of the public health versus the intrusion on the civil liberties.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's great enough. The danger for the seasonal influenza is not there. Or even if you might argue it is there, it's a risk as a society we've sort of accepted.
Accepted, yeah. So this has been a really interesting discussion, Trudy. I think it brings to the foreground a lot of issues that local, state, and federal health officers and other folks really need to think about and examine before something like this hits.
Absolutely. Now is the window to be doing that if you are in those roles, to be thinking about what are your policies going to be? What is your plan for if COVID-19 becomes widespread in the U.S.? This time is the time to be doing that. And we are certainly seeing enough examples of things that can be done and how things could be done to be formulating that plan. So thanks for talking to me.